And welcome back. Microsoft Virtual Academy Day 3, XAML Development Module 2, Responsive Design.
Yep, sounds like you rehearsed it.
I've been saying it over and over for the last 10 minutes.
It's unfortunate because it's the wrong module.
Oh. No,
it's
not. yes. All right. So, responsive design. Of course, usually that's a web developer's term.
Why don't we show the agenda just so people know where we are today?
Oh, that. Yes, let's do that. So, where are we right now? Module 2. You get to look forward to branding in the next module.
Absolutely.
You just have to endure responsive design.
Indeed.
It's going to be good. All right, so responsive design, generally speaking, is talking about handling scaling. That would be the change in quality of different monitors that are using, or different devices and monitors especially, that are looking at your app. Also, interacting with visual states. Specifically, the visual states around Snap View and those other views that we have to support inside Windows 8. And then localization, all the things that your app needs to respond to, right? Change in location, change in scale, change in orientation. So that's what we'll be talking about now, but let's begin with scaling. Scaling, Darren, is not the change in, is not handling the change in size of the monitor, like as it gets 27 inches, 32 inches, 88 inches, that sort of scaling is another topic. Right?
Correct.
We're going to be talking about the scaling of your images because what happens is if I have, no, let's say you have a terrible device. It's better because that way I have a better one.
Oh,
so let's
I
say
see.
You have a terrible device that is a 10-inch tablet. And you're looking at the image because you the resolution on your device is okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And you look at the image looks fine.
Yep.
I have an excellent device because I've spent the extra money.
Uh-huh. You're
and
not
so
cheap, is that what you're saying?
I'm not, right, and not in this scenario at least. Not in our virtual world. So I have this really sweet device, ultra high. It's 1 billion resolution by 2 billion. It's really good. Can you imagine?
That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it costs
that's
a lot.
That's beyond good. That's extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to be in the virtual world, I'm going to up my salary. So, the anyway, so I've got this. I've got two of them, actually. One just as a backup.
And so I've got an image, and I'm showing an image
gotta
that's
get back. Yeah, right.
200 pixels by 200 pixels.
Right. Yours looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It comes on my super high-res one. It looks terrible. I can see all the pixelation. I can see artifacts, blocking.
So that's if it's been scaled up.
Yeah.
If you show it at the native resolution, it's like a little dot in the corner.
Yeah, right. And so Windows 8 will handle keeping it the same size for you.
Okay. Now, when we're talking about the same size, are we talking about the same sort of physical dimensions as it appears on the screen?
Physical dimensions, that's right.
Yes.
So on yours, it's 2 inch by 2 inches, let's say. On mine, it's going to be the same. That
okay.
Windows 8 will handle that part, right, that side of scaling. And that's when, in our previous day, we mm-hmm. talked about resolution independence.
Yeah.
And that's really what that is about. Now we're talking about images, and how do we handle it so that when I do go to a different device that does have better resolution, my low-end images look good for them as well. I
mm-hmm.
could give you a really high-end image as well, but then I have to deal with all that new memory footprint, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a high-end image is still that much more memory, right? That much more taken up. So how does Windows 8 handle it? Handles through scaling? All right. I think we talked about that a lot. All right. So here's the device and a pretty good example here, and it shows how we do it. We basically need to supply our application with all the different assets. So I would supply a low-end asset. We would call that the 100% scale. And then I also can handle the high-end asset, the 180% scale, and then one in between, that 140%. So
mm-hmm.
I can give all three. There's no other way to do it, right? I mean, there are other ways to do it, but this is easily the one that's built into the framework.
Yep.
I can provide all three this way. I don't have to, right, if it doesn't find the one that I want. And it's all handled by naming conventions. And so I put in this case, it's you can see that it's test.jpg. Test.jpg is the file that scale-100, scale-140, and 180. Those are all hidden from me. I don't see those as I interact with them. I would never call the image test.scale.jpg, right? I would
mm-hmm.
All I have to say is test.jpg, and the framework handles the rest for me. I could put that as in the file name or in the folder name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's up to me how I want to kind of put that. It'll hunt for it. If it doesn't find it, it'll give you the one it can find.
Okay. if you want to cut over to my monitor, I can actually show a sample of that.
Ah, beautiful, beautiful.
So here we have a project, one I prepared earlier. And we're showing the design view, and here's the XAML. Now, the thing to note is I'm showing the image source as /assets/splashscreen.png.
All right, so that's the image, splashscreen PNG.
But if I come over and look at my assets folder, there is no image called splashscreen.png.
Ah, yeah.
I have splashscreen.scale-100.png, -140, and -180. And so the system is choosing which of those images based upon the current scale.
Even in the designer.
Even in the designer.
Yeah, that's
and
amazing.
So now if I look at the device view, so here I can see, I can select a bunch of different resolutions, and it tells me what scale it's going to be showing at. So this is currently showing at 100% scale, and we embedded in each of these images the scale, so you can tell the difference between them. So we see 100 here.
Yeah, yeah.
If I change the scale of this
now,
device...
Now, even on that list, you can see it's telling you what the scale is going to be, isn't it?
Yes.
100, 120, 140.
So if I change the scale to... So it's the same dimension of device, but it's higher resolution, therefore there are more dots per inch, so... To show the same physical size of image, it has to make the image larger. So it's at 40%, and what we, or 140%, I should say.
Yeah.
And now we can see it's pulled in the image that's embedded with 140 in there. So we're now on this image from our resource file.
You still reference it as splash screen PNG. It's the framework doing everything for you.
Exactly. And so once again, to belabor the point, if we select 180 scale, then we can see 180.
If you were to scroll, actually zoom back just a little bit. The size of the image really hasn't changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's still maintained inside the app the same.
Yep.
It's just swapping out to a higher quality image.
Correct.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome. And pretty neat that we are able to do it right there in the designer. I don't have to go buy a whole bunch of devices in order to test it. I could also do it with the simulator. Simulator has the same functionality.
Perfect. And, you know, this is part of the new richness of the XAML designer within Visual Studio. It was very hard to do this stuff in the previous version.
Ah, yeah. Nice. Okay.
Cool. That's scaling.
That's scaling. And scaling for resolution. Right. Okay, so that's scaling. Very beautiful. Let's talk about now managing visual states. So visual states are unique to XAML. And they are basically our way of describing on a control level, inside the scope of a single control, what styles should be applied to it. That's the best way to think of a visual state. And so visual states themselves can be grouped together. So let's go through kind of what some of the pieces of visual state. So the visual state manager is a static class that allows us to interact with and change the states. Really, it's the only way for us to do it. And every page has a group of states. So if you can't have just one visual state. I suppose you can. I never even thought about it. I guess you can just have one visual state, but it doesn't make sense. But hopefully you'll have two. And I think on the right here, this really demonstrates the core classic sort of use case for it, and that's the button. So a button has a series of common states. And so see how states can be grouped together. So the first is a series of common states, hover, normal, press, disable, just like you would expect, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whenever it is, you know, CSS has hover, you know, it's kind of similar in its own way, I suppose. Anyway, so as you go from normal, hover, press, each one of those implies any series of styles as well as a transition. And so what I mean is, as I go from normal to hovered, I want to switch it so it's not highlighted, let's say, or it is highlighted, I guess, because I'm hovering. But I don't want to just switch it to hover. I also want to apply a transition, which is just a storyboard like we talked about in the previous module.
Mm-hmm.
And that will allow me to change its color, but change it with inside an animation and make it as beautiful as I want. So I can have a transition into every state from every state. So I could say when it goes from normal to hover, it does this. But when it goes from press to hovered, it goes this. Or I could have a generic that says when it goes to hovered from any state, it does this. And so I can have all kinds of granular control over the transitions between states. And each state then is a inside its animations, usually through keyframes, it allows me to swap out whatever the styles are as well. So there are all kinds of things you want. So you create a user control or on your page you want to make some changes to it, do it with states. How do you switch between states? Easy enough. That's what the visual state manager is for. Go to state allows me to change the state. I pass in the scope, I pass in the state name, and whether or not I want the transitions to execute, which is nice because sometimes when the page loads, you do want to go to a specific state.
You want to pre-configure a state.
But you don't want it to start animating.
Yeah, you want it to be there like snap.
Yeah, so you can say no transition. So it's very nice. So I have that visual state group that brings them together. The visual state group will tell me whatever its current state is, and I can have more than one visual state group if it turns out that the states are in conflict with each other, right? So you can see that there's both common and focused. Whenever it's focused, it may or you know have dots around it, you know how they have that kind of little decoration on it or adornment to show that it's focused. But at the same time, you want to show that it's disabled. So you can see how you can be both focused and pressed, unfocused and hover, focused and hover. So you would want different groups because they are exclusive to each other. And so you can be as complicated or as simple as you want to. In our card example, I could easily have created states that say face up and face down. And then the animations that we created would be the transition between those two states. Inside my card, I could say face up, it flips it over, face down, it flips it back. And again, the scope is inside the control. So if that card were a user control, then I could have that 20 times on my page. All 20 of them could have unique visual states inside them. All I have to do is say visual state manager.go to state and set the scope to that individual control.
It's very powerful.
It is. And I think a lot of people don't, a lot of people steer clear of visual states, right? It feels like it's an advanced, well, it is advanced, but you know, it sounds almost unattainable or unapproachable, but it's really not. It's once you see it, there's nothing to it.
Once it gets laid out and you can also use the tool to actually create copies of the styles and everything that's applied to existing controls. So you can actually see how the existing framework elements are actually managing these states, which is pretty interesting.
I think we did that in the other day, where we pulled out button and kind of looked at how you could pull out the existing template and see all of its visual states and how they managed them. Pretty neat. Okay, so again, Blend does storyboard animation as well as visual state animation. I mean, it'll handle all your visual states. In fact, there is no way to manage visual states in a designer without using Blend.
Correct.
There's just no way to do it. You can always type them manually, but that's the only way. If you want to preview them, you have to go through your entire app without using Blend. So, all right, let's take a look and see our app that we created, our Jumpstart app.
Yep.
I have it up right here, and it handles, there we are. It handles orientation as well. So let me pull up. In fact, let me run it for a second. I'll just remind everybody kind of what we're looking at. So here's the app starting up for me. And I'm using the simulator sort of on purpose, to be honest. All right, so I want to, so you can see how it's laid out. I've got a little advertisement right here, and it goes to the right, and it's tall, and then everything kind of continues horizontally from there. If I were to rotate this so that it's portrait, not only does it hear it, but it also changes the layout. You can see now the advertisement is vertical, or horizontal, I mean, instead of vertical, and the information kind of carries down, and then I can kind of scroll to the side. Really nice, right? I can respond to whatever the user
is
doing.
So this is one of the key tenets of really building these applications so that they can work well on tablets and so on and so forth, is creating this experience across all the orientations of your device. So a well-designed application will support these things out of the box.
And of course, don't forget the orientation of Snap View as well. It's something you have to support. And so, again, last time, yesterday, I guess, a month ago.
Years ago.
We talked about the layout aware page and how the layout aware page helps detect the orientation change and then sets the view state for you, right?
Yeah.
So these are sort of the view states that are expected to be there, right?
And you have the stubs are put in place for you.
And those stubs are put in place, right. So let's look at how we implement those. That's what we want to see here. Here's the detail page, right? There we are, that page, right? Let's look at how it is laid out. So let me just scroll to is it at the bottom or the top? There we are. So we talked about the view state group, or the visual state group. The visual state group contains all the different visual states. This is the visual state group right here. It's called application view states. I think it's worth saying on a layout aware page, this is a required name. This is the name it expects to, and if it is there, then you have the nice feature of being able to go into the devices pane and dropping down those view states. That's really nice, being able to switch between them and see them. And if I went to snap, let's say, it would go to snapped, or if I go to filled or portrait, right, it swaps all those out and executes them for me. So that's the reason this name is a required name. Again, if you are doing these custom, you can create your own right here, just my own visual state group, call it Jerry's States, and start putting my own visual states inside of it. All right, so here's my first visual state, and a visual state is just a name and just a container for a storyboard. That's its transition. And this is the storyboard, and you can see the keyframes really come in here. So as I move from, let's say, filled to full screen landscape, or from portrait to full screen landscape, I wanted to do three operations. Each one is a object animation using keyframe. Here's another one. Here's another one. Each of them targets a different control. This one's targeting a grid called fill view, a grid called snap view, and a grid called portrait view. They're all being collapsed except fill view. That's because I'm going into the full screen landscape mode. And that is basically swapping out. And if you look up top, I'll just collapse these so we don't have to look at the content, because that's not going to be an important part here. There. I have three grids, fill view, portrait view, and snap view. Each one has unique UI, Darren, because you know you can allow it to kind of morph for you. Sometimes that works. Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't, right? You really want it to look a specific way because you're taking care for the experience.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, we want to be intentional about how our apps look. And so we know in portrait view, we have much more vertical real estate.
Yeah.
Now, the key thing is to remember that the design tenants state that even in portrait view, you still scroll horizontally, you don't scroll vertically.
Yeah.
Only once you transition over to the snap view do you use vertical scrolling.
Yeah, that it is tempting when you're in that a taller that you want to keep scrolling vertically.
Yep.
But so that you match the rest of the ecosystem that you want to scroll horizontally. And so a lot of people are like, well, I want to take this. In fact, I just got this question just last week. I'm transitioning from snap view to fill view. I want to take the grid that I'm using in snap view. How do I move it into fill view? And I think that's just not looking at it right. If you're data binding your XAML, which I hope you are, then you want to implement it twice, right? You want to have first implementation in the fill view. You want to have the next implementation in portrait, the next implementation in snap. So that'd be three implementations. Each one bound to the same data, so you don't repeat the data, but each one with a unique UI experience, right? So the first one may have a little bit more padding on this side. Portrait may have it may allow it to wrap a lot taller. When you go to snap view, you'll use a list view instead of a grid view. And so there are all these choices that you make, and doing it like this so that as you navigate between different view states inside your application, you have unique environments like this that the entire view has changed. It gives you all kinds of flexibility to make it as elaborate as possible. Don't try to reuse your controls so that you're moving them around. Just do it again, right? The XAML engine is smart enough to know what you're doing, to know what's not visible so it doesn't have to render it and go through all the extra exercise. Sometimes you might abstract those away to user controls. Sometimes you don't, right? It's up to you. But either way, having three unique UIs sometimes plays out to be the best. Sometimes the fill view and the portrait view can be exactly the same. And that just depends on your application. Anyway, so this is the way I handle view states. Visual states. It's hard not to say view states.
I know
it's just it catches my brain. And anyway, they're visual states. So these visual states. But I could create my own custom ones as well. I think that's the most important thing is that when you have, in fact, if you look at the search contract in Windows 8 says shows that when you have results, it's a view state or a visual state of has results, and when you don't, it's a visual state of doesn't have results. This is really a handy way of showing on a grid that you don't have something, right? Instead of detecting whether there are no items, if there is no item, then what, inject an item that says no items or overlay a text box or what instead of messing around like that, a visual state allows you just to swap out the UI so that the grid is gone, maybe, right? And you have just a screen that says there are no items here. And the visual state handles everything, and inside it, the transition or the storyboard inside it handles all of the manipulation. And because it's a storyboard, it can also be beautiful,
yes,
right?
Yeah, you can introduce the transitions that we've talked about beforehand and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Anyway, so that's a visual state. I think they're a lot more approachable than people think, right? Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps the quickest way they get caught up is that they're at the scope of individual control. Every control can have a set of visual states. The page itself has visual states. All of the objects on it has visual states, including custom ones. Pretty nice.
Pretty nice.
Pretty nice. And from the code behind it, it is just that static method of go to state. And so it's an easy interaction. And if I were, in fact, look at this, Darren. I'll show you one more thing. Sorry. I always seem to want to open Blend, but I'm going to do it anyway. All right, saying
it's because you love it so.
I do. I really do. Well, I like what it can do. That's what I mean. And yeah, I mean, it's fine. It's beautiful. It's dark. It's dark. A lot of developers use the dark theme. I'm not that developer. Okay, so it'll load up the page that I was on. That was the detail view. And what's nice about it is the states tab. And so you can see all the states are right here. And if I enable transitions, as I move between the two, it not only switches them out, but also shows the transitions between them. I don't have any transitions.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think this is worth pointing out. As you do a transition, as the orientation changes, there's sort of that it backs away.
Yeah, pop in and then pop out.
And that's built into the that's a Windows 8 action, right? Mm-hmm. That's not you. There's not a part of the animation that says back away a little and pop back in, right?
Yeah.
That's all handled for you. It's already there. So you don't have to implement that in order to get it, and you also don't override it, right? That's the way that it actually is. But being able, so here I could just say, right here I could say add a new state, right? So now I have one in addition to snapped, I have, something else. And it's really nice if I was in my own user control or something. And now I can really start building on. Under here, I can say add a transition. You can see you have a transition from every state
mm-hmm.
or any state, which is the best way to think about it. And it makes it really easy. And then from that point forward, I can use that same timeline or storyboard builder that Blend has that we showed in the last module.
Yep.
Very powerful.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. Sometimes. A compliment is
sometimes
well placed.
I hit it.
Yeah. Sometimes. Rarely.
I'll show you a little piece of candy in the app that we built here is if you do go to SnapView, let me drop to SnapView real quick. There's no room to play it anymore, right? And so we have this one button, this little play button,
mm-hmm.
and this is cool. It unsnaps the app. A lot of developers don't know that you can unsnap an application.
Yes, as long as you're doing it in response to a user action.
That's right. That's kind of the gotcha. I mean, that's funny how often that question comes up, that they use try and snap. That's the mm-hmm. method. And in fact, let me see if I can find it here. There it is. Try and snap. Easy enough, right? And you call try and snap, and it will take you from the snap view back to the fill view or mm-hmm. the full screen, depending on what you're running.
Yeah.
And it has to be in an event handler that is caused by the user.
Mm-hmm.
If you try and call it programmatically, it will never work.
Yep.
Never work. You can't do it on a timer. You can't do it on a loaded event. You have to do it on a user-initiated event.
Yeah, it's basically letting the user control their experience.
Yeah. There also is no try snap, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's only try unsnap. And it's just for this purpose. If your app can't work there, you mm-hmm. give them a quick way to jump back.
Other things as well that you can detect whether you're in snap mode, because if you're in snap mode, you don't want to necessarily show your settings. Because the way that the settings works is it comes in from the right-hand side. If you're snapped to the left-hand side, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And so you're actually unable to do that in that scenario.
That makes sense, because sometimes you always want to use the charm to get the settings or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you'll add the button in your canvas, go get your settings from here. Then you're in trouble all of a sudden, right? Because you're showing what doesn't actually fit inside that 320 area.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, that's visual states. I think one of the cooler parts and how we handle orientation using layout-aware page and the animations that are in there. All of this is inside the app. Mm-hmm. And we didn't mention this at the start of the module, but this and all the samples that we go through are all available at xaml.codeplex.com, xaml.codeplex.com. All right, so the next way we can respond to the user's environment and make sure our application is relevant to them is through localization.
Absolutely.
We know that the store is available to 231 different countries over...
And increasing all the time.
And increasing. Well, eventually we'll hit them all.
One hopes.
Yeah. What's the total number, I wonder?
I have no idea. Yeah. It changes very frequently, and I think different countries also recognize different countries, so it makes it very different.
Oh, it's probably controversial once you get up real high.
Exactly.
Yeah, no doubt. And, and it also has 71 plus languages as well. When your app gets delivered and it goes to all these different regions, having it in their language, not everybody speaks English.
Mm-hmm.
Not every, or British, I mean.
Indeed.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about localization. What are our options inside a Windows 8 application?
So first of all, we also need to think a little bit about, what's the difference between globalization and localization?
Oh, yeah. Good.
So they're actually two terms. And so globalization is really the process of designing, conceiving how your application is going to operate in multiple geographies with multiple languages, is to think, okay, if I write something in English and I write something in Spanish, the dimensions of the characters that fulfill that phrase could well be different.
Yeah.
So don't create a very fixed layout that is constrained to, say, the four letters that I expect to say in English, where for good, where bueno, I'm not a Spanish speaker, so hopefully that is good, is more than four characters.
It's and like a so, kung fu movie.
Exactly.
The guy goes into a monologue, and below it says hello. You're
exactly.
Like, come on.
Yeah. Exactly. And so you need to make sure that your application is reactive and responsive to the characters that are being supplied for the phrases.
Yeah.
Flexible layout. Also, you need to think about, don't use local colloquialisms.
Mm.
Don't use phrases that mean something to a specific locale, but a nonsense to somebody in a different country. They don't understand the meme. There's no point. So use very clear, simple language that can be easily translated.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Use general images. Again, if you mean a car, show a car.
Mm.
Don't try and hint to something that means something again in the context that you may be in, but doesn't mean anything to somebody in Norway or whatever. And so again, think about those
things. Do Norwegians, do they have cars?
I believe so. I believe so. They also have skis.
Yeah, no doubt.
And they hate you right now.
Yeah, exactly. I love them though.
That's
I really
good.
Do.
That's good. So the other thing to bear in mind is, strangely enough, not everybody uses the same date format.
Yeah, yeah.
Not everybody uses the same number format. So again, don't constrain your output to fixed strings based upon how you believe the date should be shown. Use globalization APIs to actually be able to render up dates in the appropriate format for the locale and the geo area that you're actually running your applications in, because these are important.
I'll tell you something funny is the XAML toolbox that comes with Visual Studio doesn't have a date picker, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a bummer, right?
Yeah.
We all want it.
We all want one.
And I talk to developers all the time about it, and they're like, well, I'm just writing my own. I'm going to make it look just like Windows Phone. I'm like, well, go for it. Don't forget this might be used in other countries where things are in other orders. All right, fine. Don't forget in some countries it's not 12 months. You're like, what?
Yeah.
And then,
Julian and Georgian and so on and so forth.
It's
That's
harder
why
than
it's
you
difficult.
Think. Yeah.
That's why it's difficult. So one of the things, if you bring that slide back up, you can see that there's a new namespace in Windows RT, Windows.Globalization.
Mm.
So this is very different than the formatting options that are available in the .NET framework. And so it's worthwhile bearing in mind that there are a lot of different formats. If you actually look at the format string there for showing day of week, day, month, year, that's a very different approach than was originally used in the .NET framework for formatting dates. So bear in mind that there's a learning curve for this to actually leverage these things. And introduce it from the outset, because it's a bit of a pain in the butt, to be honest, to go back through an application after you've already built it and then introduce these concepts from the outset.
The globalization namespace is special also because when you ask for day of week, day, month, year like that, it's sniffing the user's settings or their device to know their location and know what it's supposed to actually look like. You don't have to do that. You don't have to have a giant switch statement that says, oh, okay, so if they're in Norway, do this, and if they're in, you know, and keep on going. None of that is necessary because of the globalization namespace. Mm-hmm. The globalization namespace looks for the local or the locale, and they go from there. So it handles it all for you behind the scenes. Very nice.
Yep, absolutely. So if we look at the next slide.
Yes.
So one of the key things we want to think about here is when you're writing your application, if you've got an eye towards the global market, it doesn't make sense to hard code all of the string values that you're going to use. Because, you know, if I put in first name, that means plenty of stuff to me and you, but doesn't help our friends, good friends, in Norway.
Yeah. they don't know what first... Do they have first names, or is it just...
Oh, well, your site is going down.
So, all right.
So, as developers, we obviously can hard code values wherever we like. You know, we can put it in code or we can put it in the XAML and so on and so forth. But there's the great thing about what's been introduced in Windows 8 is the ability to really leverage resources to help out with this. So we can actually move these elements into resource files. So something that's a little bit interesting is...
Now, we've always had resource files.
We've always had resource files.
We usually call them ResX, not ResW.
Yes, and there's a little bit of disadvantage to a certain extent with reverting back to the ResW, which was the old format.
Yeah.
Is the ResX used to do a lot of code generation for us.
Yeah.
That it would admit code that we could leverage in our code behinds and in our view models to go and retrieve this information, normally strongly named. So, you know, we could turn around and get our resource.firstname.txt or whatever, and that would come straight back to us. We don't have that capability today. However, they take away, but they also give back. There are some great enhancements in terms of being able to make your user interface localized, in that they've introduced a new attribute that you can place on your XAML elements. It's in the extended namespace, so it's prefixed with X, but it's the UID. And this allows us to refer to a resource. And the runtime will actually go away and find the appropriate resource and inject that value to us.
Oh, okay, so in code there, you're using the resource loader to go get firstname.txt. There's firstname.txt. And in XAML, you use UID firstname, and that is...
So that's doing something really clever, because what it's doing is the .txt is, in fact, mapping to a property on the text block. And so what this allows us to do is we're specifying go away and get the resource called first name. And it's going to iterate through all those resources and find everything that starts with first name. Then anything with the dot prefix, it's going to assume that that's a property and it's going to take that value and inject there. So now say first name, if we actually look at the resource there, we can see that it's first name is the text in there. We could actually specify first name dot width and put a numerical value in there. And we could actually then turn around and drive the width of the text block based upon the size of this text string.
Ah, that's awesome, because we were just talking about how, depending on what the language is, it may not even fit.
Exactly.
So we can do a resource file for every language?
We certainly can. And you know, manually, we can add those things in.
Ah, yeah. Now, so when I'm looking at the name in the resource file, firstname.txt, literally saying first the element whose UID is first name, dot text property is
equal to first name.
Nice. And then the framework is swapping between different resource files based on whatever the language is of my machine.
Absolutely. And there's a specific structure that we need to leverage, which we'll show in a moment. But if we had to do all of this manually, this would be pretty painful.
Yeah.
You know, especially seeing as I am, as we've already said, not a Spanish speaker. And so it's pretty difficult for me to do that. I know a little bit of French, but again, I can't translate French much. And clearly, Jerry knows nothing about Norway.
I'll do all the Norwegian trans.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
Yeah, no Swedish chef.
I'm not doing that.
Yeah,
but it's funny though. YouTube.
Okay, so a great tool that's been made available to us is the Multilingual Toolkit.
Yeah.
And so it's a Visual Studio 2012 extension. So you can
brought to us by the Bing translation team.
Good guys.
Yeah.
All around.
Yeah.
And it provides translation support. So what does that mean? Well, it gives you the ability to actually manage translation services. So you can actually have various states of translation where you can leverage the tool to automatically generate translation for you. Now, because it's a machine translation, that may mean that although the words are translated, the phrase may make very little sense to a native speaker.
Yeah.
So you should always endeavor to get a native speaker to review your translations, because you may inadvertently introduce a colloquialism that means something
about their mother.
That would be unfortunate.
wait. So what we're saying is the toolkit helps translate things for you.
Yes.
Odds are 99% of it is great. Don't trust that 1%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, if you're doing a heavily branded experience for a well-known name.
Yeah.
Make sure that you go through that. If you're building something for yourself, and you know, it's more of a casual application and so on, then, yeah, the customer base, your user base, will be more forgiving.
Yeah. Right.
But you know, if it's a very large professional application, those types of errors can
it's worth
grating.
The effort to go through it.
Exactly.
The multilingual app tool. I wish I could see it in action, Darren.
You do?
Yeah. Do you have it installed? Can you just show it to me?
I do. That's funny. It's funny you should mention that.
I want to see it.
So let's bring up Visual Studio. Slowly but surely. Okay, so we have a couple of different scenarios that we can show here. So this is a very simple application that kind of demonstrates some basic concepts.
And I see four text blocks and three text boxes. All right, great.
Absolutely. So this is basically just simulating some sort of form-based application for data entry. Let's not worry too much about what the application does.
Sure.
It does
very
little. Here we have our text blocks. And so if we come down and we look at the first text block.
Now, Darren, you said not to hard code the text, and I see that you've hard coded the text.
Absolutely.
First name.
So this is interesting. One of the side effects of this resource-based environment is it actually only executes at runtime. So whilst we're doing our design time experience, we will want to introduce values that show up in the designer so that we know what our application will look like.
So, I mean, we do want to see things in the designer.
Exactly.
Okay, so the language swapping through the resources is not happening in the designer.
Correct.
So if you are changing your locale on your machine and you're not seeing it update,
yes,
and you're in the designer, I've heard this happening to people.
Yeah, I don't know who it's happened to. I've no idea
try
who
running
spent
your
a
app.
Lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah, try running your app.
Yes.
Right. Okay,
so
got it.
Bear that in mind. Yeah,
so
no
these
matter-
are just placeholders.
These are placeholders that we can use for creating our basic designed experience. As you can see here, we have the UID that introduces the first name label. So if we're setting this up to use resources for the first time, we have to follow some conventions. Within our application, we need to create a folder named strings.
Okay.
Within there, we need to create a folder that's named for our current default locale.
Makes sense.
Which is English-US.
Okay.
The capitalization of these strings are important. Otherwise, your resources will not be found.
Okay, got it.
So it needs to be named EN, lowercase, dash, uppercase US.
All
okay?
Right. Got it. English, US English.
Exactly. Inside there, we create our resources file. So now I'm going to open this up. So bear in mind, this is called first name label.
You just right-click, add new items,
exactly.
And it's just called a resource file.
Exactly. In fact, add new item. Select through. It's not a resource dictionary. Don't add that one in.
It's a XAML file.
That's
not what
file.
We want.
This is what we want, the resource file. And they've, because people kept making that mistake, they now stuck .resw in the name. So you know, oh, this is the resw that you want.
Right.
Face so we add
on.
That in.
Got it.
And then this is what it looks like, is basically a grid view that shows us our string names, our values, and any comments.
You have to think through the names, don't you? Because if you had a pretty large app with a lot of controls, and then you go from view to view to view to view, you could have a lot of first name controls.
You could do, but equally, for consistency, you can actually use the same UID across multiple controls.
You can, okay.
So that
every first name is first name.
Is first name, and it gives you one throat to choke when you want to change that name. You just go in here and you change it. Say instead of first name, you want to say given name or something along those lines.
Yeah.
You can come in here and it's going to be reflected throughout your application. So again, that can be a great time saver in terms of putting this stuff together.
And if the IDs for whatever reason do confuse you, you can just put comments on the side so you can have a little clarity, right?
Yeah.
Because then you have it
so,
third column.
here we have our first name, so we're following that convention. This is the UID, and then this is the property name. And so we have first name label. So if I come back and look at this app, I can see right now first name shows as dev.
Right.
If I run this,
yeah.
Now we can actually see it's just showing first name.
Dev is gone. Nice. Because so, I'm pulling from the resource file to fill its text property.
Exactly.
That's neat.
So that's pretty cool. Yeah, that shows that this is working for us. So if I switch back and shut that down, what we have now is a resource file that's full of American English.
Oh, yeah.
And we want to be able to support...
You mean English. You just mean English.
No. American English, man. American English is deviated from the path.
The path. Path. It's P-A-H-T-H.
Indeed. So, but we talked about the multilingual toolkit, and we talked about this as being something that could add some capabilities.
Yeah, right. This seems like a lot of work, frankly, so
far. It does.
I mean, sometimes you
imagine a non-trivial application where you may have hundreds, perhaps thousands of these strings?
Yeah, and then do you want to... Oh, yeah. No, I can't.
Yeah, exactly. We really don't want to talk about it.
Right.
So, the multilingual toolkit. I've already installed it into the application, into the environment, and I actually already have it enabled.
Oh, I see. Enable, disable. I see.
So I have it already enabled.
It's the first catch, really, with the toolkit. A lot of people they're wondering why it's not working.
Why is the magic not happening? You've got to go into Tools and select Enable or Disable.
Yeah.
Once you select Enable for the first time, it creates this subfolder called Multilingual Resources.
Okay.
And it creates this basic file, which is a pseudo language file. That's just basically getting the baseline environment set up.
Gibberish would be another way of thinking of it. Yeah,
exactly.
Sure.
The .xlf extension is actually an industry standard. This localization file is compatible with many of the localization tools that are used throughout the world in generating these translations.
Yeah.
And so it actually participates in a greater community, which allows you to ship these things off to get them verified in other tools and translated.
Right. There are professional translators out there, and xlf files are what their tools expect to receive.
And so right now, we actually already have an xlf file that's set up for a French based in France. If I bring this up, we can see that the toolkit actually creates...
Oh, yeah, look at the grid at the bottom. Editor. It looks just like our resource file.
Yeah, and we can see all the source. But we can also see a translation. So we've already run a French translation here to actually produce these characters. And it's actually just as simple as running the translation capability.
Could we try to create a new one?
We could, but what we'll do is we'll demo this one first to switching through and to just show that as we shift the locale, we're going to bring these resources in. So we can see that this has already been created. And so there's a little bit of setup that you need to do on your system to be able to switch easily between languages.
Oh, yeah.
And so one of the things you do is you can set up this keyboard. So you can actually turn around and select different keyboards. And once you've added a new language to your keyboard, you get the ability to be able to quickly switch up language preferences. And so what we have here is the ability...
No, but wait just a second. If somebody's watching and they're like, well, how do you get the keyboard thing in the first place?
Uh-huh. I shortcut that for a reason because I forgot.
Yeah, it's as easy as hitting start and typing language.
Yep.
And as soon as you do, it'll take you to the exact same UI that you were showing, right?
Yep.
If you go to...
So we've got language, and we can select on our results
settings
here. It's all right, I've got it up. And you select add a language.
That's it.
And it brings up this UI.
Yeah.
And so if we wanted to add another language, we could come in here and specify add another language. But what I'm going to do right now is switch our primary language from English US to French.
This is the technique to communicate to Windows that from this point forward, apps need to be in this language if it's an option.
Yep.
And if not, fall back to English.
Absolutely. So I'm now going to move French up and make that my primary language.
Oh, that's brutal. Go on.
So now once it's set up, you'll notice that nothing changes in the designer because, again, the designer is not resolving these resources during design time.
Right.
If I now run the application, what we now see is we have all the translations.
Oh, very nice.
And we're also showing a different date format as well because we're using that global date formatter to bring in the different dates and translations for those dates.
And in your location, or in that location settings, you could add many different languages.
Absolutely.
Put them in the order that you prefer. You may speak more than one, two languages. Put them in the order you prefer, and it falls back so that you can support more apps.
Yeah. So let's add another language, as you mentioned.
Yeah,
so,
let's do that. Where do you click?
So remember, we clicked in Tools to enable and disable the multilingual toolkit.
Yep.
But to add a language, we need to go to Project. So go to Project, Add Translation Languages. So up pops a list of languages.
Now, make sure you have the correct project selected in your solution if you have a lot of different projects.
Correct.
You're going to be adding one to a weird one otherwise. Let's see if Norwegian is in there.
Oh, we want to go Norwegian, huh? Now you're throwing me for a loop.
Yeah, I'm changing up the script.
Okay, which one do you want? Bokmål or Norsk?
No, Norsk. I mean, first things first.
Now, you notice that there was an icon next to the other one that said Microsoft Translation.
I'd rather the other one then.
Exactly.
Let's do that.
Yeah. Because there's a risk there of that actually not being automatically translated.
But we wanted to show off the toolkit
anyway. Exactly. So.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, that didn't do what I wanted it to do, did it?
Yeah, I'm throwing you for a good loop.
Yeah,
now.
That's what happens. Dynamic demos. Okay, so we're going to go the one that's marked Microsoft Translator because that gives me a clue that it might be able to help us translate.
Of the many languages that the Bing Translator does.
Yep.
You know, that's not every language.
Exactly. So we're going to add that. So now what we've got is a new file. It's been added to our project.
Yep.
And I can right-click on that and say, generate machine translations.
And so that is going to go out to Bing for us.
Yep.
If you weren't connected to the internet, it actually wouldn't work, right? It takes all of your strings, sends them off, gets back all of the Norwegian versions, right? Now, have I thrown you totally off?
I think you've thrown me totally off now.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. Had to compile. So now what we've done is we've brought in our basic translation. So we've got the source, but we can see it hasn't been translated
yet.
Yeah,
I see that. Now, before you click it, this translatable dropdown, I think, is worth mentioning.
Yep.
Not everything, because you're setting so many different properties, right?
Sometimes
it's numbers, sometimes it's color. You're going to set it to red. You don't want it to be rouge all of a sudden
exactly.
In French. And so you can set that so that the translator doesn't go in and garble it.
And equally, you also may have, you know, perhaps your app name is a commonly known name. Your app name isn't going to change throughout your locales, and so you don't want to translate that. You want to leave that as jumpstart.
Yeah.
You don't want to translate that into something else. So yes, great point. So anyway, in this scenario, though, we want to translate everything. So I'm going to hit translate all. And now it's going to go out to Bing. And as we can see here,
yeah, it's done all the work. Now, here, let me just double check. Yeah, those are all right.
Oh, dear. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Okay, so...
I was raised in Norway for 6 years.
So now we have that file, and that's now incorporated as part of our application.
I wasn't really.
I could tell. The reason I could tell is your Pinocchio nose is now hitting the monitor. So, and again, because we've been completely thrown off here, now I need to add another language.
Oh, yeah, we need to add that language.
So let's add a language.
Do you remember which one it was?
It was Norway something. So I'm hoping it's the default one.
You could search that too, right?
So it was Norway Bokmål, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure your...
My pronunciation
is right, but yeah.
It's Bokmål, whatever. So if I move that up...
Your accent needs a little work, as Wayne Shatner says. That's a funny commercial. Have you seen that? That's a good commercial.
I have not.
Oh, it's really good.
Shut up. So now we've switched that language, and yes, fortunately, I did choose the right one. And there we go. We're now seeing Norwegian appearing.
We're goofing around, but that was awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah,
I mean, it just exposes this whole global marketplace to you guys as developers. And to be honest, it's an opportunity missed if you don't take advantage of this toolkit.
Yeah, I mean, you could just go through language.
Now again. As I say, if you're building a huge branded experience for a big name brand, you'll want to go through the whole translation lifecycle, which is to prepare this candidate translation, to submit it to an external agency for verification. And this tool will actually track it through its various states, whether it's in a draft form, whether it's been approved.
Yeah.
And if you go in and make changes, it'll move it back into a draft state and so on and so forth. It's very, very powerful.
And there is work to be done. I mean, you're going to need to go into every control and change and set its UID. You're going to need to go at one time set up your because what you don't have is another resource file.
Mm-hmm.
It's just those XLIF files,
yep.
And so it's the toolkit taking care of that for you.
Absolutely,
you could do it by hand, but.
Now, we can actually open up and view those. If I say open with the XML text editor.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Then we can actually see these.
That's the XLIF format that it's putting everything into.
And we can see, so I opened up the French one. So we can see that the source is globalization and localization. And the French is pretty much the same.
Yeah, only in French. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice.
And you can see why we English use S instead of Z.
So the English resource ResW file. Is the template
yes,
for everything
else. It's the master.
Else. Yeah.
You know, it's almost to a certain extent as if you were using something like T4 mm-hmm. and generating information out from a template.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if T4 were behind this.
Exactly.
To be honest.
So.
Localization.
Localization,
brilliant.
Globalization, and some tools to support it.
So we're talking about flexible render design.
Responsive
reactive,
design.
Responsive design. That's it. And, you know, we want to be able to...
You can always read your slide.
Respond. Maybe I should go to the module, yeah. So we're talking about scaling it when the device changes and you see better hardware, better resolution, we can give a better experience to the user so that they can see higher quality images. Also using visual states as the standard way for XAML applications to interact with... or to handle changes in state, right? That's the way if your application has, or if your controls have more than one way they're supposed to look, visual states are the right way to do it. Don't detect it some mm-hmm. other way. You take just leverage what's there.
And I see actually that the Norwegian in the chat has validated a pronunciation, it would appear.
Yeah, I was just giving you a hard time.
Uh-huh,
I knew that too.
Uh-huh. Eat it.
All right, okay. And then localization. So let's take a 10-minute break, Darren.
Absolutely, and we'll be back.
All right, thank you. See you in 10 minutes.